yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they'd found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show, Alternative Visions. And today we're going to continue in our series of four shows that began last week on the question of which way to independent political action. Okay, independent, we mean independent from the two wings of the ruling party in this country, sometimes called Republicans and Democrats. And maybe that faction within the Republicans doesn't know really what they are quite, the so-called Tea Party. Independent of those formations is what we mean by independent political action. Okay, but what else does it mean to say we are discussing and or advocating independent political action? We're not concerned here with the why. Why it's necessary. We're going to take that for granted in this series because we're talking to folks who are already engaged in independent political action. And we talk about on this show quite a bit what's wrong with the policies and programs of the two parties and what a mess they've made of everything here, and the mess is getting worse. If you don't believe that, just watch in the next few weeks and months. The global economy is already, again, cracking at the seams, and it's going to get worse before it gets better. Okay, so we're not so concerned about, why we should do it. In other words, what's wrong, and therefore we should undertake independent political action. We're taking that for granted here in this series, assuming it's necessary. But then the question then becomes, what do we mean by independent political action, other than independent of the two parties? Okay, well, are we talking about mass political demonstrations and protests, like we saw with the environmental movement a few weeks ago here, and rallies and so forth, as we see in Ferguson and Missouri and places like that against police militarization and police brutality? Are we talking about direct action of some kind, a la Occupy, or XL pipeline protests and so forth? Are we talking about lobbying independent of the other parties? What about running for elections? Local elections, national elections, state level? Or are we talking about the need to form some kind of political party or join a political party? What's the best strategy for independent political action is the question here of initiating, engaging, and continuing independently. What are the tactics that flow from the particular strategy, the organizational form? There is a relationship, between the strategy you adopt and therefore the tactics and the organization structure that's best appropriate for a certain strategy. Well, we're going to welcome here today Jill Stein, our eloquent presidential candidate with the Green Party USA. I had hoped to have a member from the Working Families Party join us as well, but it doesn't seem they're all that interested in joining in the debate. They were concerned about debating this issue. Right? It would have been interesting because they have a strategy that's sometimes called fusion, a fusion strategy. And it would have been very interesting, I think, to have them express their view in that regard. But, apparently they're not so interested in joining us. This is a reflection, I think, of a real problem in progressive circles, and that is the refusal to cooperate and unite with each other. Everyone, kind of likes to go their own way. It's a form of sectarianism. They refuse to join each other on and join with each other on common efforts and common issues and so forth. And that's a broader reflection of a a more fundamental problem in American progressive politics, I believe, and that's that single-issuism, where everyone prefers to run off on their own little issue, you know, play big shot in a little pond, instead of getting together and giving up some of their preferences for uniting and having more influence, you know, in a broader social movement. Well, last week we started this off, and we had a typical left labor progressive representative in the Labor Fightback Network, Jerry Gordon, and we had a traditional left party view. I mean, old left party view here with Jeff Mackler, and I think folks maybe saw some interesting differences. And by the way, I got to apologize to the listeners a little bit. We had a problem in hearing. Jeff had a problem, and he just sort of continued on and on, and I tried to interrupt him and see if we could get more of a discussion going, but we weren't able to do that. He couldn't hear. I think he has a hearing aid problem. In any event, I apologize to listeners for that long monologue. We don't want monologues. We want discussion. Anyway, that's behind us here last week. And so we had this traditional left view last week. And this week, we have a new different party, progressive party view. We have the Green Party. And as I said, unfortunately, don't have the Working Families Party. And next week, just to let everybody know, we're going to have a very interesting person on, Mark Dudzik, who was perhaps the main organizer of the Labor Party in the 1990s. We almost got to launching a Labor Party in the 1990s, but that did not pan out, and that analysis will be very interesting. And, you know, this raises a question that's typical in the labor left and progressive left, and that is, oh, we need a labor party. Only the unions have the power to lead us, and it's got to be a labor party built upon the unions. That's an old 1930s view. Well, I'm not so convinced about that view, and we'll have a discussion next week. I don't see much evidence that the traditional trade union movement is going to take any kind of lead in this regard. In my view, they are hopelessly wedded to the Democratic Party, and as the crisis for labor, organized labor, gets deeper, they attach themselves even more firmly to the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party leadership knows that, and believes there's no place else for unions to go and labor to go, therefore they deliver less and less for them. But we'll have that discussion next week. Okay, and then the fourth week right before the election, we'll have some independent local activists who've been running for offices and winning at the city council and mayor level throughout the country, several different places. So we'll talk then to people who are actually doing and having some success in independent political action. Okay, so that's the context for our discussion and our series here in a run-up to the midterm elections. Jill, thanks for coming on again. You're always very welcome on this show. We're very insightful, and our discussions, I think, are very, very productive. Glad to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Jack. I'm loving what you're saying already.
Okay. Let's jump right into the theme that I want to discuss today. In other words, let's not bother with the long litany of what's wrong with the two wings of the single party called Democrats and Republicans that are ruling this country and have been for quite some time. Now, let's just assume that they aren't doing the job, and we could spend hours and hours describing how the job is not really being done here. And let's jump into the real meaning of the show, and that is, what do we mean by independent political action? What does this mean to the Green Party? Obviously, the Green Party is a party. Therefore, it has decided that forming a political party is the road to independent political action. How is the Green Party's party approach to this topic different from other parties? What is your strategy? What are some of your tactics? In other words, describe to us what to the Green Party independent political action means.
Great. So, you know, I think starting with your question about how is the Green Party different, you know, and what does independent political action mean to us, you know, I think for starters, we are independent of the political establishment, which is a tool of plutocracy, of oligarchy, of Wall Street, of multinational corporations, whatever you want to call it, you know, the incredible predatory power that has seized hold of the political establishment, but the workings of the entire political system really are held hostage by this extremely corrupt machine, which takes marching orders ultimately from the guys with very deep pockets, you know, financial institutions, big banks and insurance companies and, you know, healthcare, fossil fuels, the war industry, et cetera, you know, the usual suspects who are basically in bed with government and running the show. And unfortunately, that attaches to the political parties as well, that is the Democrats and Republicans. And I dare say some of those who claim to be independent, but in fact are equally on the receiving end of big corporate money. And, you know, many of the libertarians, I think, and the Tea Party fall under that wing. Now, there are some, you know, people, candidates, et cetera, of integrity within, certainly within the libertarians, some misguided Tea Party folks who, you know, don't take the big money. But there are very few political entities that are not corrupted by the big money. So that is a principle of Greens from the get-go, that we do not accept corporate contributions, and generally we do not accept money from the surrogates of corporations either, that is from their executives, office holders, attorneys, et cetera. We don't accept corrupted money, and often there are limits on the size of donations that we accept and so on. So, you know, it's an imperfect safeguard, but it is a safeguard nonetheless that attaches to the Green Party.
I think if I could add for our listeners, you know, Tea Party is, at least a significant portion of the Tea Party is directly funded by the Koch brothers and others. If it weren't for Koch brother money, you probably wouldn't have had all these Tea Party candidates challenging Republicans for nominations everywhere. So that's an interesting point. Okay, Green Party strategy includes we don't accept money from corporate sources.
Right. We refuse to be corrupted. And then I think, you know, another way that the Green Party is different, you know, it's also called an anti-party party. And it was founded, among others, by anarchists and people from social movements. In the United States, it was founded in 1984, actually, the National Party. And in part, it was a spinoff from Germany, and it was very inspired and impacted by a book describing the German Greens, which actually used this term, that it was an anti-party party. So, you know, I think from the get-go, the Greens have been people who've been, you know, sort of recruited kicking and screaming into the realm of electoral politics, and I would include myself in that group. So we come to it with a lot of skepticism about its, you know, its vulnerabilities, its potential to be corrupted, and so on. And I think it's a very healthy skepticism. And very much the Green Party has grown out of social movements starting in the 80s. And people think always, you know, about the environmental movement, but, you know, it grew out of, as well, the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the peace movement. And they have all been very much at the leading edge. There was a debate for many years after the founding of the party in this country whether it was going to be just a movement, a social movement, whether it would run candidates or not, and at what level it would run them. And, you know, I have to say this dialogue, this debate is really built into the DNA of the Green Party, which is inherently decentralized, inherently founded on social movements and struggle at the community level, in the streets, and, you know, has spilled over into electoral politics. But the feeling, you know, and this is my feeling as well, is that it would be foolish to only struggle in the street and not include the voting booth within that struggle. Likewise, it would be crazy to only struggle in the voting booth, because at the end of the day, it's social movements that really create transformations. And we are at a point in history right now where small, you know, small tweaks along the margins, you know, changing the window dressing is not sufficient to our survival economically, socially, politically, and ecologically. You know, we really
So your strategy is both social movement actions and activities around social movements and electoral. I think that's an important distinction that people should know, that you don't make a distinction of either or, you know, as some do. Some say, oh, you know, it has to be all electoral, and some organizations say, oh, no, you know, you can't even think of engaging in electoral politics because that's the road to corruption, right? So,
exactly.
And you're saying that, you know, either or, mutually exclusive, is an error on both extremes, that a social movement is necessary if you're going to do any kind of real electoral activity, and electoral activity is necessary to solidify the demands and gains of a social movement. Otherwise, it will just dissipate as the impact of the social movement ebbs and flows. Is that fair?
That is fair. And I would also say, I think there's general understanding that social movements are the real engine of change, and that political parties and candidates reflect that and sort of need to approach the political process with a lot of humility, as opposed to the way that conventional politics works, which is, you know, sort of egomaniacs who are living in their own bubble and, you know, just express incredible disregard and disrespect for social movements, and are usually at odds with them because they're way contrary to their interests.
I agree with you. I mean, I watch these politicians today, and I watch what they do and what they say and everything, and the thought that repeatedly comes to my mind is, these folks show increasing symptoms of sociopathic behavior. They want to be loved, and they lie through their teeth 98% of the time, and you know, they're narcissistic, and it just goes on and on, and it's just amazing when you look at it and you say, why would anyone want to be that kind of a politician? I don't understand it, but I think you're absolutely right.
It's no wonder that their ratings are so abysmally low. You know, I think we've hit, you know, Obama's hit his all-time low, and Democrats and Republicans, you know, are also hitting their, you know, all-time low. I think it's 33% favorable for Republicans and 39% favorable for Democrats. The unfavorable rating for Democrats for the first time has passed majority status, so it's now 51%. Unfavorable rating for Democrats. This is like a poll this week from Washington Post, ABC News, you know. So the public isn't buying it, you know, at all. But because the media is so corrupted, you know, we're in a emperor's new clothes, you know, kind of politics where the voices of, you know, of disagreement just are not heard. These guys wouldn't pass the laugh test, you know, if there were a real barometer out there of public opinion. They don't pass the laugh test. But because our communications infrastructure is so firewalled, so separated out from reality, you know, it's just, you know, it just creates a lie and then, you know, supports the lie and propagandizes the lie continuously 24/7.
How does the Green Party operate organizationally? I mean, you could conceive of a party structure where you have to officially join some of the traditional left parties. You know, you're required to to pay a certain amount into the party to keep, its finances going. Others, you can just say you're a member of the party because you agree with its philosophy and its programs. What does it take to be a, quote, a member of the Green Party?
Well, the Green Party nationally is decentralized. So every state really has its own rules. And, the rules are different state by state, not only in terms of what the party says, but also the structures for elections and registration and all that are very different. So there are some states in which you cannot register for a party. And it makes it very difficult for the Greens to count their membership. Generally, it's simply by registering Green or by being registered as a sort of declined state or, not being registered in a party, then one can affiliate with the party and thereby be counted as a Green. So it's an extremely chaotic system nationally. The rules for participation in politics, whether as a voter or as a candidate, the system nationally is extremely confusing. So it's very hard for independent parties like the Greens, which don't have a lot of money, to administer their parties and even know what their membership is. That said, there tend to be a group of activists within each state that are connected to the party and that actively work to secure ballot status, to maintain a website, to reach out to Greens to try to recruit candidates and, make sure that we have access to the ballot and conduct, ballot access drives and so on. So it makes it a lot of guesswork. And this seems to be part of the game plan of the establishment politics. They make it very hard for people of integrity to be politically active. It is, it is a system designed to obstruct, political gathering and, movement building.
So it sounds to me like there is no national program or platform. I mean, when the regular parties, two wings, Democrats, Republicans, have their conventions, they come up with a party platform, in other words, of positions, values, and so forth. Is there any such similar thing in the Green Party if it's organized state by state, or is it a different state by state?
Yes. There is a, there is a national level to the Green Party as well. And that national party has gatherings every 2 years. We hold a meeting. And actually, I'm sorry, I believe it's every 1 year we have an annual meeting. And, every 4 years, that meeting is also a nominating convention. We have a national platform, which is extremely detailed and well-researched. It's generally very well thought out, and we make an effort to keep it current. And it is a repository of a lot of very helpful, useful, information and positions. The state parties largely derive their platform from the national, but there are some that differ from it. Slightly, but I think nationally there's pretty good consensus at this stage of the game on our major policy positions, and our candidates for the most part are pretty uniform. They share they share positions on everything from from 100% clean renewable energy by 2030, which tends to be our sort of one of our key ecological goals, is to be 100% clean renewables by 2030 in time to solve the climate crisis. We support healthcare as a human right. We support generally putting energy into the public domain, free higher public education, ending student debt, simply abolishing it, ending the rights of corporations to personhood, et cetera. These are basic positions that have been pretty well vetted and absorbed by all the state parties.
Where could listeners go to if they wanted to look at the national program or statement platform, whatever you
and
want to call it, Green Party?
GP.org. That's Green Party, GP.org. And that will take you to the Green Party's homepage, and from there you can, you know,
go
you
to different states as well.
Then, well, to get to the states, there are some you can get through to the website, which is undergoing reorganization, by the way, so it will be easier to navigate soon. But you can also just Google Green Party of your state, and that's probably the easiest and most direct.
Okay. Okay. Now, what you described was kind of tiers of membership here. At the very general level, people are considered, quote, green by registering for in elections as greens, or in those states where you can't de facto, there's some percentage of that is going to be registered greens. But then you say you have this active layer among those, presumably who have registered of membership as well. What can you tell us about that active level of membership? Is it a large proportion of your total membership? Is it growing? Is it regional, stronger in certain regions than others? I would presume so. All parties have that characteristic.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. Because we don't have a really strong and well-funded national party, we don't have great knowledge about what's going on all over the country. And I find myself, as the former presidential candidate, I often just get contacted by state parties who say that they are organizing, and would I please come out to a state party organizing meeting. And recently I was actually in Missouri and in Colorado, you know, places we don't normally think of as strongholds of the Green Party, North Carolina, and there's great stuff going on. And, you know, in Texas, you know, I mean, who would have thought in Texas that they would be running 50 candidates for, you know, state rep and local office?
Well, when you have 10,000 fracking wells just in the vicinity of Fort Worth, there are certainly issues of great import in Texas that have to do with the actual destruction of the environment. I mean, gosh, in 10 years, Texas is going to be a cesspool.
Oh, and indeed, this is going on, you know, all over the place.
Yeah, that's true, not just Texas.
Really, I mean, it's virtually everywhere that, and then it's not just fracking, it's also, you know, coal and coal ash and the spills and, you know, like that recent spill in West Virginia, you know, that polluted the water supply of a major city. You know, it's like this has become the norm and not the exception. And so it's a big wake-up time that, you know, we are only as healthy and secure as our water supplies, our air, our climate, and our food. And they're all, you know, they've all been privatized. They've all been really, you know, polluted and degraded. And it's a fight. There's an incredible fight for survival that is engaged really all over the country, all over the planet. And, you know, the name of the game is unifying that fight, because when you put people together across these fronts of resistance, it's a very powerful, it's not just a plurality, it's a clear majority. You know, there is a rebellion which is in full swing. And I think one of the really exciting things going on right now is that there's an effort to bring these rebellions together across the silos that we generally are divided by. As you mentioned, you know, we have this ridiculous history and culture of organizing in separate silos. And, you know, it is a state of divided and conquered. But, you know, we are beginning to push back against that. We saw that happening big time in the New York March, the People's Climate March on September 21st, with practically 500,000 people turning out. And, you know, it was really from across the spectrum of social movements, from the anti-war movement to you know, there's very strong components of racial justice and economic justice, and even some unions, not very many, but there were a few. But there were a lot of fight and angry, you know, rank and file working people and unemployed and poor people. And it was, and Native Americans had a very strong leadership role as well. So, you know, this to me is the name of the game right now. And the Green Party, because it is the one national, non-corporate, non-corrupted party, it's kind of become the gathering place. And this to me is so exciting. There are many campaigns we have right now, which are examples of progressives coming together, lefts and greens, socialists and greens, who are running, you know, on the same tickets, or socialists or other, you know, far lefties who are running on the Green Party platform as endorsed greens. You know, it's very exciting. This trend has been in the works actually since the founding of the Green Party. And because the Greens, I may be anticipating some of your later questions, but because the Greens from the start had, what shall we say, no illusions about the establishment parties, the Wall Street parties, capability, you know, integrity. We had no illusions that they were not going to save us. So we were not shy about standing up and asserting the politics of courage. Whereas, you know, the dominant mode out there has been the politics of fear. You know, you can talk courage, but when you run out of fear, and you run worrying about who might get elected. So you run and you tell people to vote based on their fears, and they vote for the lesser evil. But that politics of fear has a track record, and that track record is that it delivers everything we were afraid of. So the Greens have been pretty clear. There's been some internal dialogue, but I think for the last 4 years, we've been very clear that we have to stand up and run based on courage, based on what we want, based on our vision of where we're going, because the lesser of two evils becomes lesser of lesser all the time, and they become really indistinguishable, and Obama's gotten away with murder that a Republican could not have gotten away with, and he really exceeds Bush, you know, on all of his policies, whether, you know, expanding war, attack on our civil liberties, attack on immigrants, you name it, the devastation of the climate and the environment. You know, he's well ahead of Bush, the bailouts for Wall Street, you name it. So the Greens have been clear. We have to stand up for who we are and what it is that we need. We cannot compromise. Nature is not going to compromise. Nature doesn't make political compromises. It demands certain things of us. So that's where we are as Greens. And, you know, that's why we've been able to maintain national party status and national ballot status. And we're really the only non-corporate party, truly independent party, that has been able to do that. So we've kind of become the place where independent parties are getting together, and it's really exciting to see.
Okay, so let's take that, and your example of the recent marches in New York, where all these different social groups have come together and are expressing not only their concern about environment issue, but their concern about their own issues, and that's good. But okay, so we take that as the latest expression of the social movements, but they're still all, you know, periodically they come together in a march or a demo, then they go back and they go their own way because there is no real unifying organizational structure for ongoing kind of action. Now, you describe the Green Party as the potential for that unification. How does the Green Party go about saying to these folks, look, we need to move to a higher level of political organization in this country if we are going to get serious about making gains? Just going out and marching now and then is good. It shows people that, hey, look, there's lots of us and we're all in the same boat, but then you got to take it to the next level. How do the Greens and the Green Party and yourself say to all those groups and organizations, let's take it to a higher level? I mean, does that mean let's call a national convention of all serious groups and discuss how we can come to a higher unified organizational kind of activity? Is that the answer? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, this is the $24,000 question.
Yes.
Social movements, as you know, especially in this day and age, are extremely decentralized. And, you know, and our tendency has been to organize within our own silos. And that, you know, that has really come to the end of the road. You know, we've gone as far as we can go on that. So I think there's a lot of interest right now among the social movements about building cross links. And in fact, I was part of a conference held in New York before the march called the Convergence. Get it? You know, the Convergence? For people, planet, and peace over profit. The idea that we have to bring together the strains of the social movement together with an understanding of the need for systemic change. We need to get out of the, you know, predatory capitalist profit-driven system, which is a unifying driver in all of these crises. So it was an effort to bring many of the movements together, and several thousand people were there. We held workshops, plenary sessions, and we are following up. So, and in fact, right now we are fast and furiously following up in advance of the next global climate gathering in Lima, Peru in December, where we hope to do more networking with other international groups and the social movements of the Global South and internationally. So, you know, I think we need to come together sort of within the social movements, and there is strong momentum towards that right now, which is extremely exciting. And I don't think political parties can just jump in because there is so much mistrust. Efforts to stand out and direct the action within the social movements are not well received from political, actually from anybody, including political parties. On the other hand, political parties with integrity need to be very involved. They need to be part of this process. They need to be among them. And indeed, the Green Party is. The Green Party was a participant in the Convergence. The state parties, as well as the national party, were members of the Convergence and are developing relationships with the social movements. And in fact, the Green Party has really grown up within social movements. And it takes a little bit of just, I think, discretion about, you know, avoiding the appearance of being a predator, because that's what political parties have become. They have typically preyed off of social movements and manipulated them and, you know, thrown money at them and tried to buy them out and buy out their leadership and so on. So political parties, thanks to Democrats and Republicans, have earned a terrible reputation, which they deserve, for destroying social movements and undermining them. So unfortunately, that's the legacy, you know, that the Green Party has to respect and has to be very careful about intruding on the autonomy of social movements. That said, in my experience, by being there as a supporter, in fact, when I was campaigning for president, I had to be very careful, you know, in going to Occupy stuff, because they were very clear they did not want electioneering. On the other hand, if you were there to support Occupy, if you're there to support them and thank them and help them in any way you can, then you're very welcome to be there and to be a part of it. And for me, and I think the Green Party, we've continued in that mode of being there to support the social movements and recognizing that the social movements are the driver. In doing so, we develop this long-term relationship and hopefully begin to win their trust. And in fact, we have in many of these organizations. The problem is that many of these social movements are still dominated by, you know, by big money, and they're sold out, and they are, you know, spineless and afraid to actually stand up and vote the courage of their convictions. But, you know, we're in a big wake-up moment right now, and, you know, look at New York, where Cuomo won't take a stand on fracking, but not taking a stand, you know, is leaving New York very open to being fracked. And, you know, and the anti-fracking movement is starting to get the word that Howie Hawkins and Brian Jones, a green and a socialist running together on the green ticket, are, you know, the best insurance policy, whether they win the election or whether they have a strong showing. This is the best way to ensure that New York not adopt fracking.
And well, I think your comments here about the Occupy are appropriate for your initial comments here, and that is an effective strategy has to be in part electoral. You have to challenge for control of the institutions of power in mm-hmm. this country, but you you can't simply do that. You have to have a social movement, and one of the Occupy's history is a good example. They did many great things in bringing to attention and showed that people can and should stand up and fight back. But, you know, that this whole strategy that we're just going to be spontaneous and our only strategy is to occupy City Hall and talk, and we're not going to really reach out and form a broader organization. I mean, we see what happens. It's easy for the powers that be to really attack that, which they did. Mm-hmm. You know, at the end of Occupy, it was police mobilizations against them and so forth. I mean, it had very positive things to show, but there were some negative things about that whole approach. Look, we got movements out there, significant social movements, as you point out. We've got this whole low-wage pay movement. We got immigrants' rights movements. And, you know, the immigrants, as you've said, Obama has treated them far worse than even George W. Bush. And we have this police oppression occurring everywhere. We got fracking, and the opposition is not just Greens, but it's average middle class folks and working class folks. Environmental justice movement are those who are being really destroyed by this fracking, and the destruction's only just begun. Really, it's going to get a lot more intense. So mm-hmm. You know, how would the Greens, other than getting, as you've described, the trust of these movements by participating as real contributors, not some outside folks saying what you should do or what you're doing wrong, but, you know, getting in there and being part of the movements, which the Greens do, how do you then take it to this higher level that is necessary politically, higher organizational level? You know, it doesn't mean they have to give up their independence and what they're doing. They can just continue doing what they're doing, but they also have to do something more unified at a higher level, including electoral and non-electoral politics. How do the Greens try to take these movements, or not take, but encourage these movements to let's unify to a higher level of organization and political activity?
Let me use Howie Hawkins' campaign as an example, because they are running at 9% statewide, and regionally they're running as high as 24%. Earlier polls showed that a truly progressive independent candidate running on the Working Family Party line had early on 24%. Actually, it might have been even a little bit higher than that, but really substantial public support and public demand for an alternative. And then, as you know, the Working Families Party went on to endorse Cuomo in spite of knowing that there was broad public support to oppose Cuomo.
Maybe that's why they didn't want to come on.
Yes, I think that would have been hard to have a debate about. But the point being, you know, this is winnable. New York is winnable for even Howie Hawkins, for a true progressive. People are fighting angry. You know, in the Democratic primary in New York, there was an opponent, a progressive opponent, to Teachout. Her name is, I forget her first name, but an attorney, somebody Teachout, who ran against Cuomo and got 40%, you know, despite being outfunded, you know, big time. So there is, there's a revolt. There's a voter revolt in the making. Cuomo is facing federal investigation right now for corruption in a commission that he founded to sort of get that monkey off of his back. And then he went on to manipulate the commission so that it wouldn't investigate his campaign donors. the guy is standing on very shaky ground right now. And if Howie Hawkins had sufficient funding even to get out a strong...
Okay, Jill, you there again? We had a little problem with the connection.
Yes, we did.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. I don't know what happened at the station here, but anyway, they got us both back on, and let's just continue. You were talking about the Howie Hawkins campaign in New York and the significant support there. Obviously, it has a lot to do with the fracking issue in New York. And, of course, other issues. People express their discontent in some of these polls and surveys, 30-40% favoring an independent candidate, and it appears to be one issue. But it's really a convergence of a lot of issues behind the scenes. I'm sure you would agree with that.
Oh, huge. But, I mean, the budget cuts that, that Guama has enacted, and these are just, it's not like this is just New York. This is the country. New York is ready for a voter revolt, but it's the same everywhere. And it's not only fracking, it's water supply, it's schools, it's teachers. It's really an attack on teachers, an attack on school funding. It's the giveaways, the tax giveaways to the wealthy that are ongoing. There are so many issues that are coming to bear. And the point I was trying to make, because you were saying, what does it take to have a breakthrough? I think the point is that the breakthrough has really already happened. The question is just how do we sort of find the right, pressure point to crack the whole nut? Because the nut is ready to be shattered. And
well, what's the green strategy for doing that?
Fundamentally, it's running very strong campaigns that get adequately funded, that have good, strong candidates that are on the money in terms of policy. And actually, we have that right now. We are very close to a breakthrough. Howie Hawkins is 9% going on 40% in a three-way race. He could win it if he simply gets hurt. And he's actually going to be in some of the debates. He will be in televised debates coming up. This is how, for example, Jesse Ventura broke through in Minnesota back in whenever it was, the early 90s. He went into a debate running at 7% in the polls. And after three debates, he was well into the 40s, and he won a three-way race.
For the listeners in New York, what is Howie Hawkins, a Green Party member, running for? What position? What district, et cetera?
It's governor of the state. He's running against.
Oh, he's running for governor. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Very good.
Yeah.
Okay. So what else is the Green Party doing other than electoral strategy in this case? As we talked about earlier, there could mm-hmm. be mass action demonstrations, rallies, and so forth. There could be direct actions, civil disobedience, sit-ins,
yes.
et cetera. What does the Green Party advocate? Has it done? Would it be doing in terms of these other strategies?
Yeah, and I'll say, when candidates are running, they tend to be going all out in the electoral mode. And actually, for my campaign for president, that included big demonstrations and civil disobedience and getting arrested and going to jail. And that was very important for the issues and for building connections and trust with the social movement. But I'll say that the Green Party has been, among the groups leading this climate convergence for people, planet, and peace over profit. And we are, we're looking at the possibility of a major event. We call it a people's climate strike. that could happen perhaps on next Earth Day. It would be a event of convergence, civil disobedience, massive boycotts, work stoppages, student strikes, along with showcasing developments at the community level that really establish an alternative, you know, local just economy. So it's a combination of let's all stand up together and sit down together, in fact, and show how strong the movement is to stop the machine and create the future we deserve. Let's do it for a day.
I think these mass actions are extremely important for people not to feel isolated and alone. If it's just electoral activity, you know, that's an individual thing. You go into a voting booth and you vote.
Yeah.
But the confidence that something can be done has a lot to do with if people see they're not alone, and that's where the advantages of mass rallies and protests and demonstrations and boycotts and all this play an important role.
Exactly, they do, and I think the run up to them is very important too, because that allows to begin creating an infrastructure and a communications network so that we work together for the long haul. As you pointed out early on, if you just have a march and then you go home, the media ignores it, and it's like it didn't happen. You know, having public events, whether it's a demo or civil disobedience or a strike or whatever it is, it's really important that it be part of a game plan going forward and be part of building structure to support that game plan. And that's exactly what we're doing right now in the climate convergence, but that's also what the Green Party is doing as a political force.
Let's go back to the organizational question. You indicated that your party annually has a kind of a convention or conference is it delegated? People are from the different state Greens. It seems that you have this federal structure as well. Do they send delegates, or can anybody come who's a Green member?
Anyone can come. Having voting status depends on being sort of accredited by your state. And generally, that's a fairly open process. So if you are becoming a member of the party, you can get involved and actually go to the national meeting as a voting member in most states. Different, you know, among different states, but generally there are open positions. So it's not hard, a part of the process. And the same is true at the state level. It's wide open for grassroots participation.
Okay, so you don't need to be a card-carrying member of the Green Party? You can just be a registered to vote Green?
Yes, that's right. It's different in different states, but for the most part, it is very easy to become a card-carrying member. If you vote Green or you're registered Green or you officially join the party, again, there are several groups. In my own home state in Massachusetts, there are several ways to become a card-carrying Green, and they're all pretty easy.
So the process is different in different states. So it's very decentralized, federalized process,
yeah.
And easy to be a member, different levels of membership. And is there such a thing as, not just electorally registered, but you are a member, you got your Green membership card, whatever. Is there that kind of level of membership too? Is it encouraged to contribute? Every organization needs some funding and financing.
Yeah.
How does the Green handle their needs for finance? I mean, if you're going to run for office, you've got to get petitions and elections that cost money. Unfortunately, it's a reality, but you do need some finances to be an effective organization. How does the Greens handle that?
We fundraise, and unfortunately, a lot has fallen on candidates to do that fundraising. During the 2012 election, Our campaign actually paid for the ballot act campaign. We paid for the ballot drive. We spent a huge amount of money. You know, the vast majority of our expenditures were spent acquiring ballot access on about 30 states around the country. Now, normally that's something that states would have done themselves, and in fact they are doing that now. But, you know, the fundraising has not been a strength of the party. It's been really a people-powered party, but those skills for fundraising are just beginning to diffuse through the party, and a lot of what we do is help parties learn how to fundraise, and it is very important. Most parties do not charge membership dues, but they encourage donations, and it's, you know, it's really critical, and it's really critical for our candidates. People like Howie Hoffman would be shooting up in the polls if he could afford a TV advertising.
How many in his midterm elections? Greens are running in how many places? How many states?
I don't have an exact tally, but, you know, my guess is most states are running Green candidates, and they may be running for, you know, for local office, for state legislature, and there are, you know, there are definitely congressional candidates as well.
Are the Greens targeting any particular level of government? I mean, we're beginning to see at the local city, municipal, city council, mayor level, a number of independent candidates running. Some call themselves socialists. Some are labor folks and so forth. There seems to be a kind of renaissance of independent campaigning at the very local level. As part of your electoral strategy, are the Greens targeting any particular level, state level, city level, whatever?
From the very beginning, the Greens have always prioritized local elections. We actually jumped in 1996, I believe, the first time. Maybe it was 1990. Yeah, it was 1990, I believe. I take it back. It was 96 that we ran a presidential candidate for the first time because polls were showing that people were demanding third party. You know, it was close to 60% of national polls were saying that they really wanted an independent third party. And that persists to this day. In fact, it's even grown what it was back then. But because Greens were the only independent national option in 96, they decided to run as presidential candidate. But the rationale for that was as much to help encourage local candidates to run and help encourage local chapters and state parties to be formed. So often we are running at a national level with multiple goals. Not only to advance an agenda of resistance and transformation at the national level, but also help lift up the local political struggles through that national campaign as well. So there are a lot of local candidates right now. We have a terrific candidate, in fact, in Washington, D.C., running on the D.C. Statehood Green Party, which is multiracial, very social justice-oriented Green Party. They're running an at-large candidate who's actually a socialist running on the Green Party ticket and has a fabulous campaign and has a has a real shot at the seat.
What's the Green Party's strategy with regard to building alliances with other social movements? I'm sure you're all in favor of that, but what are you actually doing to work more closely with different social movements and particular possible allies in these social movements?
So I think, you know, probably the biggest example of that is what the Green Party is doing as a member of the Global Climate Convergence, where we are, you know, we're up to our eyeballs, you know, in social movements and working with them as a partner and again, getting candidates who reflect.
Well, I guess we got a signal here that we're running out of time, but obviously we could just continue talking some more. But if folks want to learn more about the Green Party strategy, go to gp.org, and you'll find more about that. And thank you, Jill, for coming on and taking so much time to explain the strategy and the organization and direction of the Green Party. And we certainly hope this Convergence Conference, that we have more Convergence Conferences,
exactly.
Not just on environmental, but on social issues as well.
Well, wonderful talking to you, Jack, and I'm sure we'll be in touch going forward. Thank you.
Okay, next week we'll have...